Hello, and welcome to this Deloitte IFRS podcast. My name is Robert Bruce, and I'm a financial journalist. The aim of these podcasts is to keep you up to date with IFRS developments and the challenges they may bring. With me to discuss the recently issued Revenue Recognition Exposure Draft are Randall Sogoloff, who leads the IFRS Communications Group, and Phil Barden, who leads Deloitte's Global Revenue Recognition Team. But first, the customary disclaimer. I should stress that the views expressed in this podcast are personal views and are not necessarily those of Deloitte. So, Randall and Phil, we finally have an exposure draft. Randall, could you start us off by telling us what companies should be thinking about now that the exposure draft has finally been published?
Sure. You know, right now, since we have an exposure draft, companies should first read the exposure draft and understand the potential impacts the proposals could have on their organizations. And I'm not just talking about the financial statement impacts, but they also need to look at how contracts may need to be modified, whether or not there need to be changes to performance metrics, and there could be impacts to debt covenants, and they want to understand the totality of impacts when thinking about the exposure draft. A company may also think about doing their own field testing, so taking actual transactions and applying the proposals, or they could even participate in the ISB's and FASB's field testing, which is expected to occur over the next several months. And lastly, companies should really think hard about commenting on the ED and letting the boards know of any concerns they have so that they could be considered during the redeliberations next year.
And Phil, are there any particular areas in the exposure draft that you believe companies may want to focus on?
Yes, absolutely. Now, I should say that there are an awful lot of different topics covered in the exposure draft, and the reality is that some of them will be of interest to some entities and some of them won't be of interest to some entities. And so it's very much a case of you need to spot the things that matter to you. That said, I think there are some topics of very general interest, and there are five that I would pick out in particular. The first is deciding when to account for something as a separate performance obligation. This is all about the building blocks of recognising revenue. The second is the question of when to recognise revenue over time. In other words, thinking about how we use the current terminology, when would you treat something as a service rather than as a good? The third is the treatment of customer credit risk, where they're proposing something really quite different from what we see at the moment. The fourth is the scenario in which you have variable consideration. So at the outset, you don't know exactly what you're going to receive and how the accounting responds to that. And the last is the treatment of onerous performance obligations. When might you need to set up a provision at the start of a contract?
Okay, well let's start there. Let's start with the first key area of identifying performance obligations. Randall, can you describe what is meant by a performance obligation?
Sure. And the term performance obligation has been carried forward from the original exposure draft that was issued last year. And it's defined as a promise in a contract with a customer to transfer a good or service to the customer. So really, in effect, it's the unit of account to which the proposals would be applied. Now, a company's decision around performance obligations and identifying them is going to drive their revenue recognition, which is why identifying performance obligations is such a key step. Would you agree with that, Phil?
Yes, I absolutely would. I think this is really fundamental for an awful lot of businesses. And it particularly matters where, when you start pulling your contracts apart into separate performance obligations, you find that some of them are goods. So there's something for which you recognize revenue at a point in time, because that means your revenue recognition is not necessarily going to be smooth over a period. And this can affect very much exactly when you recognize some revenue, whether it falls into one period or another period. Now, the basic idea here is fairly similar to what was in the previous exposure draft, but it has been refined somewhat. So it's almost a two-stage process here, really. The first stage is to ask yourself whether some goods or services within the contract are distinct, because unless something is distinct, you won't be able to treat it as a separate performance obligation. And the idea is that something is distinct if either the entity regularly sells that good or service separately, or the customer can benefit from that good or service either by itself or together with other resources that are readily available to the customer. So those are the circumstances in which something might be distinct. But something that's new in the new ED is a sort of restriction on that, which is that in some circumstances, things that you might have thought were distinct because of what I've just said actually won't qualify. And this is where you meet the following conditions. I'll set them out, but then I'll explain what I think they mean in practice. It's where the goods or services in the bundle are highly interrelated, and transferring them to the customer requires the entity also to provide a significant service of integrating those goods or services into whatever it is that the customer has actually contracted to receive. And the goods or services are significantly modified or customized in order to fulfill the contract. Now, that sounds quite complicated, but just to give two really easy examples of what it might mean. If you think about a car manufacturer who has a production line producing cars that are all slightly different because they are all slightly tailored to what the customer has ordered in terms of upholstery or what have you, but is essentially a fairly standard process, it might have been possible to argue that revenue for those things should be regarded as breaking down into various distinct elements, because you could theoretically buy all the parts for a car. You could perhaps theoretically pay someone to assemble those parts into a car. And yet I think everybody would expect the revenue recognition for a car coming off a production line should be a single item, and it should be at the point that the customer receives the car. Now, if we try to apply these tests to the car, what we see is that the parts and their assembly, they're very highly interrelated. There's a significant service of integrating them. The parts are significantly modified and customized in order to produce the car, which is what the customer is paying for. So we wouldn't unbundle that. We wouldn't treat that car as consisting of separate performance obligations. We'd expect to see that as a single item. Now, contrast that with a contract in which you've asked somebody to supply you with a desktop PC and a printer cable, and you'd like them all connected together. There, I think we probably would be able to break that into separate performance obligations, because those are all items that could be bought separately. They are all items that have use either by themselves or in conjunction with other items that are readily available. So it is entirely possible that if you had only supplied the PC and not yet supplied the printer and the printer cable, you might nevertheless say, I have satisfied one separate performance obligation here. So I think that is the main idea here. And I've picked some rather easy examples, but I think it might be quite grey in the middle. This is a new concept. The boards, in my view, rather struggled with trying to put this into words. They went through various permutations at the board meetings. We've now got some words that I think are reasonably understandable. The question is, how widespread will their impact be? How much judgment is actually going to be needed in some cases to decide whether or not you're going to pass this test of being able to say that items are distinct? I don't think we know yet exactly what the impact of that will be. But there's one final point I should mention, and then I'll move on from this subject. But that is that as a practical expedient, sometimes you won't need to separate performance obligations if the pattern of transfer to the customer would be the same regardless. To pick an easy example, you might obtain both phone line rental and internet connection from the same provider. Those are probably separate things that wouldn't necessarily be important to split them if, in fact, they're both going to be recognized over time anyway, because the profile would be the same.
You know, Phil, it's interesting, and you mentioned the new criteria about goods and services that are part of a bundle being highly interrelated and looking at that aspect to determine whether or not you have separate performance obligations. I remember observing the board meetings during this discussion, and when the boards were discussing this criteria, they seemed to focus on the construction industry, so that every nail used to build a building would not be considered an individual performance obligation. It's really the building in totality that's the performance obligation. But, and I heard your examples with the car and the computer, but it just seems unclear to me what other specific industries this would be relevant to. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's very early days at the moment. But one industry that I would highlight as worth thinking about this is the software industry, especially if your business model involves supplying what you might think of as a fairly standard license to some core software and then some services associated with that. It might be quite common at the moment to treat the license as a separate performance obligation. I'm not yet clear whether that will still be true under these proposals and exactly where the dividing line is going to fall.
Okay, let's move on to the issue of the timing of revenue recognition. Phil, what can you tell us about how a company would determine whether to recognise revenue over time or at a point in time?
Yeah, this is a very big subject, and it's probably one of the two main areas that the previous exposure draft was criticised for. The previous exposure draft said, let's just have a single model that applies to everything. At the moment, of course, we tend to think of goods and services as being two separate things. Previous exposure draft said, let's not do that. Let's have a single model that applies to everything, and that model is based on the idea of control. What people said was, well, we think we can understand what the idea of control means when we apply it to goods. We are struggling to see what it means when we apply it to services. I think the boards thought that was fair comment. They've spent quite a bit of time expanding this guidance. To some extent, I think what they've come up with is an expansion of what was there before. I think there are also some new thoughts. So quite a bit that's new here, but the basic idea is still really the same. So the core idea is that you recognise revenue over time if you are satisfying a performance obligation over time. And that will be the case broadly if you are transferring control of the item to the customer over time. Now, there are then two quite separate tests that you can pass to show that this is the case. One of them is the one that we've already seen in the previous exposure draft, which is that as you do your work, the customer has control of what you've done. So let's take a really easy example, and this was easy under the previous exposure draft as well. Maybe there's a hospital that has some land adjacent to its current buildings. It would like a new wing built on that land. It approaches a construction company to construct a new wing for it. When part of that construction work has been done, it's very likely that the hospital has title to that part completed building. It's very likely that it has control of that part completed building. And therefore, it's very likely that the construction company is transferring control of the work in progress over time. Effectively, as it does a bit more work, the customer gets control of that extra bit of work that it has done. So that's the first test, which is familiar from the previous ED. And it was always fairly clear then how that would work for construction companies. An example of something where it was not at all clear was professional services. And the new guidance that we have is probably a bit clearer for those, but it's also a bit more complicated to apply. The way that it works is this. The first question you have to ask yourself is whether the work that you are doing creates an asset that has alternative use to you as a seller. If it does, then you won't get revenue over time. If it doesn't, then if you can pass one of three tests, you will get revenue over time. So let me first of all explain what's meant by alternative use, and then I'll come on to what the tests are. But alternative use is the key here, because unless you can say this asset has no alternative use to me, you don't move on. You don't get to recognise revenue over time. So the idea of alternative use is essentially that the work in progress, if you like, the work you've done so far, is something that you could sell to somebody else, not this particular customer. And there are two reasons why you might not be able to do that. One of them is because it is inherently customer specific, and it would just not be realistic to sell it to somebody else. Nobody else would want it, or the amount of work that would be needed to change it into something that would be suitable for somebody else would be so high that in reality you wouldn't bother. The other possibility is that you're contractually restricted from selling it to somebody else. You are contractually obliged to sell it to this particular customer, and that is, I think, a new thought, and that may be quite important in the property industry. So if you can pass this test of saying the work I've done so far has no alternative use to me, then you will get revenue if you can tick one of three further tests. The first one of these is that the customer receives a benefit as you perform each task. Now, I think this is really just a variation of the control idea. Effectively, the customers had the control because they've had the benefit. It's just it may have been consumed immediately. They might not have anything ongoing to show for it. The second test is that another entity wouldn't need to substantially reperform the work that you've done so far. Now, this one needs to be caveated quite heavily, because it sounds from what I've just said as though that might be of quite wide application, but actually I think it's of quite narrow application, because you're not allowed to assume that anyone stepping into your shoes would have the benefit of anything that you currently control. So the main example of this is probably transportation services, because if you are engaged to transport something from A to B and you've got two-thirds of the way there, somebody stepping into your shoes would not go back to A. They would pick up the item from where you are now and travel on to B, and therefore they wouldn't need to reperform. But I'm not sure that it will be of much wider application than that. The third test is the one that I think is particularly interesting, and I think it's probably also going to be most relevant for professional services. And it's all around payment rights. You pass this test if you have a right to be paid for your performance to date, and you expect to be able to fulfill the contract. Now, an important question here is whether the customer is entitled to cancel the contract. If they're not entitled to cancel, then as long as you think you can complete the contract, that you will complete the contract, and therefore you will receive the full contract amount, then you will pass this test as far as I can see. However, if the customer can cancel, then you need to think about what terms apply in the event that they cancel. So if the contract says, if you cancel when I've done 40% of the work, you have to pay me for 40% of the work, and likewise, if you cancel when I've done 57% of the work, you have to pay me for 57% of the work, then that sounds fine. If actually the contract says, if you cancel, you still have to pay me the full contract amount, that also sounds fine, because you will receive enough to cover the work that you've done. However, if there is just a single fixed amount that's payable on cancellation, regardless of how far you are through the contract, and that amount is significantly less than the full contract price, it seems to me you probably won't pass this test. Because if you're actually a long way through the contract at the point that the customer cancels, the amount you receive is not going to be commensurate with or more than the value of the work that you've done so far. So in that situation, you wouldn't be able to recognise revenue over time. So just to sum up, because this is quite fiddly, the new idea here is based on a concept of alternative use. If you are looking at something that has no alternative use, then you can recognise revenue over time, providing either the customer gets benefit as you go along, or somebody else wouldn't need to reperform what you've done so far, or you're entitled to be paid for the work you've done so far. And it's any one of those three.
Yeah, and I also wanted to add that an entity that determines that recognizing revenue over a period of time is appropriate, they also need to make sure that they have an appropriate method to recognize that revenue. And some may choose to use an input method, some may choose to use an output method to measure their progress towards completion of satisfying their performance obligation. Also, the board decided that if an entity ends up purchasing goods that are transferred to the customer before the related services are performed. So for example, if materials, construction materials, are delivered to and controlled by the customer before the construction commences, the revenue relating to those goods should be equal to their cost. So in other words, the entity would recognize a zero margin on those materials.
Okay. Let's move on to discuss the treatment of customer credit risk. Randall, what does the exposure draft require here?
Yeah, there's been a change from the original exposure draft. And just to go back to the original exposure draft, it proposed that entities adjust the transaction price for credit risk, both initially on the transaction date and subsequently. So initial adjustments would have been part of the probability-weighted transaction price, which would be a direct reduction of revenue, and subsequent adjustments would be accounted for as income or expense rather than revenue. And there were a lot of concerns expressed in comment letters over netting essentially bad debt expense and revenue. So the boards changed their view, and the revised ED would require estimates for all expected credit losses. So that's the initial estimate and any subsequent adjustments to that estimate, to be recognized in a separate line item within the income statement, but that has to be adjacent to the gross revenue line item. So revenue and bad debt expense would not be netted together as one single number, but it still would represent a change from today because bad debt expense would not be presented as an operating expense.
So this proposal relating to a presentation of bad debt expense adjacent to revenue, what should companies be concerned with?
I think there are two things here. I think one is they should be aware that this is going to give much greater visibility to their absolute levels of bad debt expense. Now, I'm sure users will see that as a good thing. The thing they should be prepared to deal with is the impact on geography, because as Randall's already said, at the moment, bad debt expense is typically sitting somewhere in operating expenses. That's typically outside of gross margin. Now that this is relocated so that it's adjacent to revenue, it's going to be inside gross margin. So any numbers that are calculated based on gross margin are going to be different. And I guess related to that, if you have ratios or whatever calculated currently on revenue, which at the moment probably does see some bad debt impact in it, there's a question of whether there'll be an impact there. There's a question of whether you should be actually factoring any bad debt element into any figures that are based on that.
And there's also quite a bit of discussion around variable consideration and determining the transaction price. Phil, could you provide us with some thoughts on that?
Yes, I can. I find this to be one of the more opaque bits of the ED, so I'll do my best to explain it in terms that make some sense, to me at least. I think there are sort of two related points here. One of them is, if you have an arrangement that has variable consideration in it, how do you come up with some numbers to report? And the second is, if there is some uncertainty over the amounts of consideration that you're going to receive, what is the impact of that? So they're very related questions, but I think it's helpful to deal with them separately. Now, the first one, how to get to a figure. There's a change in the ED from what was proposed in the original exposure draft. The original exposure draft proposed a weighted average approach. So it said, look at all the possible outcomes, multiply them by the associated probabilities, add together what you get, and that is your probability-weighted expected value. And that's what you should use. Some industries thought that was okay. Other industries thought that that was very problematic. They thought it was quite unnecessary, a lot of extra work and not particularly meaningful. The boards have reconsidered this, and the ED now allows a judgment over whether to use that approach or whether to use the most likely amount, which is obviously a single number and probably quite a bit easier to come up with in many circumstances. And the idea is that you should use whichever one of those is most predictive for your particular circumstances. So I think some would see that as a relaxation. I think it's probably a helpful change. Now, the other change is a little bit more complicated, because it's how to deal with revenues that are really quite uncertain. And there's a change of methodology here. The original exposure draft dealt with this at the stage of working out how much revenue you should be accounting for in total before you allocated it to the various performance obligations. And broadly, what it said was, if the percentages that you would have been attributing to the various possible outcomes are not sufficiently reliable, if you're really not too sure what they are, you might have to leave out quite a lot of variable consideration. That had various consequences that weren't particularly desirable. What the boards have done is to rethink this, and the new methodology says, no, come up with your expected value, or your most likely amount, conceivably, but certainly your expected value, without worrying about that. Bring in your best estimates. Don't worry about just how uncertain some of that might be. And instead deal with uncertainty as an ongoing constraint. That constraint is that at any point in time when you're partway through the contract, the cumulative amount of revenue recognised should not exceed an amount that you think you are reasonably assured to be entitled to. So I think that is probably an easier way of dealing with this. I think it may also give some more meaningful answers.
And while we're discussing the transaction price, I did want to mention that the ED requires the consideration of the time value of money. And the transaction price would be adjusted to reflect the time value of money if the financing component is deemed significant to the contract. The revised DD actually provides factors that an entity should consider in making this determination. I'll go through those very quickly. The first is whether or not there's a significant timing difference between when the entity transfers the promised goods or services to the customer and when the customer actually pays for those goods or services. So the longer the period of time, the more likely that the time value of money will be significant. Whether the amount of customer consideration would be substantially different if the customer paid in cash at the time of transfer of the goods or service. And you also want to consider the interest rate in the contract and the prevailing market interest rate. So those are three factors that you should consider in determining the significance of the time value of money. Now, there is a practical expedient, and that is if at contract inception, the period between the transfer of goods or services and the payment is expected to be 1 year or less, then this assessment's not required. So that is a little bit of a relief.
Okay, our last topic is onerous performance obligations, another controversial topic. Randall, can you talk us through what this means?
Sure, and you're right, Robert. This has been and continues to be a very controversial topic because the proposals would result or could result in an entity recognizing a loss on a particular element in a bundle of goods or services, even though the contract as a whole is profitable. So under the revised ED, the unit of account for the onerous test would remain the performance obligation. That's what it was in the original ED, and that's what it is in the revised ED. So even though the contract as a whole, again, is expected to be profitable, a loss may still need to be recognized on an individual performance obligation if that individual performance obligation is deemed onerous. Now, in making this assessment, the costs used in the onerous test and the measurement of the liability would be the lower of the direct cost to satisfy the remaining performance obligation or the amount that the entity would have to pay to exit the performance obligation if the entity could do so under the contract. Now, the boards did provide some limited relief because they have decided to narrow the scope of the onerous guidance. So it would be limited to those contracts with performance obligations that are satisfied over time, and that time period is greater than 1 year. So there is some limited relief, but at the end of the day, there are going to be some industries that are impacted by this. Because of the unit of account being the performance obligation that the onerous test is tested at.
Thank you. Phil, any last thoughts before we wrap up?
Yes, I'll try to be brief. First of all, I'd like to reiterate the point I made at the beginning, which is that there's a lot in this exposure draft. There's a lot that will matter to you that we haven't talked about. I've not touched on warranties, for example. There's plenty in there. And I won't try and use this space now to do all of that instead. Three areas that I would particularly single out as being of importance. The guidance on how you allocate the overall contract price between different performance obligations now explicitly acknowledges that in some cases it may be appropriate to use a residual approach. In other words, effectively you're going to come up with the right numbers for everything except for one element and then assign whatever is left to that element. That will be important for some industries. A second point to flag is the extent of disclosure. I think it is fair to say that disclosures at the moment around revenue are not huge. They will definitely be bigger as a result of the ED. Quite a few different disclosures are proposed. There's clearly going to be quite a bit of judgment needed in deciding exactly how extensive your disclosures should be on any of those particular proposals. Worth thinking about that now, I would suggest. Finally, in terms of the specifics, the transition requirements in the ED, I think I would be unwise to describe them as either generous or lenient. There are some practical expedients proposed, but they are relatively small. So effectively, this ED is something that has to be applied retrospectively. I would start thinking now about what that means with you. Exactly how difficult is that going to be? And finally, An overarching question that the boards are asking on this ED, I think, is a very good one to think about now, which is all about sense. Has the ED been drafted in a way that makes sense to you? Can you understand what it is proposing? And if you can, and you are able to work out what it means for your accounting, will your accounts make sense to your users? So is this going to result in something that is actually meaningful? Because at the end of the day, revenue is one of the most meaningful numbers in your accounts. It does need to mean something to your users.
Randall Sogoloff and Phil Barden, thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for today, but please look out for more of these podcasts in the coming weeks. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.